This is the Public Radio Hour on 89.3 Huntsville, our award-winning mix of special programs and homemade radio features. In the next hour, our public microphone was on hand at Huntsville's recent forum on mental health awareness to gather some public perspective.
Yes, there's mental health care for adults, but when you're trying to find a psychologist for a child with severe ADHD or anxiety, we're finding a very hard time to get kids in and to get them the adequate treatment.
You'll also learn everything you need to know about NASA's International Space Apps Challenge and why Huntsville being named a main stage city is a big deal.
It gives Huntsville great visibility. It's great entertainment. It's really going to help expose students to the STEM aspect.
And we're honoring Hispanic Heritage Month by previewing some of the Latino-flavored programming on our schedule. Alt Latino updates us on storm recovery efforts in Puerto Rico. The Public Radio Hour is next. This is the Public Radio Hour on 89.3 Huntsville, our weekly mix of special programs and homemade radio features. Coming up this hour, we'll talk with Tony Eberhardt from Urban Engine and Hal Brewer of Intuitive Research and Technology Corporation about NASA's International Space Apps Challenge and why it's special for Huntsville this year. We had a great response to last week's presentation of Alt Latino as part of our celebration of Hispanic Heritage Month, so we're doing it again. This time, you'll take a tour of hurricane recovery efforts in Puerto Rico. But first, let's dig in deeper to a topic we've been exploring the past few weeks, mental health awareness. Community Newsroom producer Kathy Main took our public microphone to a recent forum on mental health held at the downtown Huntsville Public Library to listen to what people had to share. Let's hear from two of the people in attendance.
I'm Richard Reynolds, and I'm from Huntsville Achievement School. I'm the principal executive director. Huntsville Achievement's been in existence actually for about 60 years, and we have a lot of kids with autism, Asperger's, dyslexia. We're also getting a lot of kids with anxiety. And what happens is, unless with the healthcare changes, unless you have a Cadillac plan, there is no mental health care. I mean, there may be something, but you're talking about there's a great disparity of getting mental health care for children. We can send a scientist to the moon from Huntsville, but it doesn't seem like we can get adequate mental health care for our children. Yes, there's mental health care for adults, but when you're trying to find a psychologist for a child with severe ADHD or anxiety or something like that, we're finding a very hard time to get kids in and to get them the adequate treatment. When a child needs medicine, they need medicine. And so there's a real problem, and so therefore I want to come and support Ms. Hall and Anthony Daniels for the work that they're doing, trying to make a difference for mental health care.
My name is Urban Gray, and I'm here because I'm concerned about the mental illness in our communities, in our cities, and especially in our churches. We are kind of in denial about some of the problems we have when it comes to mental illness and other health issues. And I feel like it's time for the church to take a more active role in trying to get help and assistance to those people that need it. When we notice it in our churches, we have a tendency to ignore it, but the problem is the people never get help if somebody don't step up and swallow their pride and assist the person or the close relatives in getting help. I told Sister Hall that my motto is, if I can help somebody as I pass along this way, then my living will not be in vain. And I feel like that we don't know how long we're going to live. Lord might call us tomorrow. But if you can help somebody today, do it, because you may not have another chance. Thank you.
That was Community Newsroom producer Kathy Main wielding the public microphone at a recent mental health awareness forum in downtown Huntsville, giving you the chance to share your stories and speak your mind. We'll hear more next week. This is 89.3 Huntsville, and I'm your host tonight, Brett Tannehill. Big news for the Rocket City this week. Huntsville has been selected as the main stage city of NASA's International Space Apps Challenge, putting it on the global stage. The challenge allows the public to team up and use NASA data to solve real-world problems and win cash. Tony Eberhardt from Urban Engine and Hal Brewer of Intuitive Technology and Research Corporation paid us a visit to tell us all about it.
The International NASA Space Apps Challenge is a program that's led globally by NASA in cities around the world. And in Huntsville, for the second year, Urban Engine will be hosting the event. And from all of those cities around the world that can participate and will participate, one or two is selected every year to serve as the main stage. In past years, the main stages have been Silicon Valley and New York City, but this year Huntsville has been selected as the main stage, which means all of the content, the competition itself, our keynote speakers, our sponsors will all be on a global platform reaching innovators around the world.
So when you say main stage, is that a main stage just for America or is that main stage across
globally.
The planet?
That's
wow,
right. Yeah.
That's huge. Hal, do you have anything to throw in?
Yeah, well, I'd like to say, you know, from a business standpoint, businesses that help sponsor the event or participate in the event are going to get international exposure. And I think this is also going to help the community of Huntsville give exposure for the talent we have here in Huntsville to the whole world.
The challenge allows people from students to professionals to team up and tackle real-world problems using data sets from NASA. What are some examples of past challenges that have been used in the contest?
You know, NASA is really, really cool in that while most people would recognize them for the work that they do in space exploration and, you know, trying to get us to Mars and back to the moon, there's so much work that they do on Earth, too. If you think about the habitats that will need to be put on any place that we visit in space, if somebody's going to be there for an appreciable amount of time, they're going to need their own food. So the work that they do in Earth science is also really impressive, and the challenges reflect that. So there will be probably somewhere around 5 to 6 challenge categories in Earth and space science. They'll be similar to the challenges that were released last year. This year's challenges haven't been released, but some of my favorites were predictive analysis for when landslides are going to occur or tools that could be put together to help first responders get to forest fires sooner. I imagine that maybe some of those challenges that we have here on Earth could one day be challenges in space too.
And to me, this team-up aspect is really interesting, and you both mentioned earlier what a great opportunity this is for exposure for Huntsville, but it's also a great chance for exposure by young people to be mentored by professionals on their teams and for businesses to gain exposure with other international participants.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's going to be great. You know, you can form teams. It can be, your friends. It can be your family. It can be your coworkers. As I mentioned, there's going to be professional teams, but also, like you said, there's going to be teams for those that are 13 and above. So kids that are in high school, college can participate. And not only are they going to get to, you know, have the fun time of the challenge, you know, it's 48 hours and you're kind of locked in over there at the Space and Rocket Center and you're going to be working on this challenge together. But it'll give them exposure to companies that participate as well. And so I think we'll have a lot of collaboration and, a lot of exposure for the kids to see, you know, some of the companies in Huntsville and what they do.
And Tony, maybe you can talk a bit about how do you make a team? What sort of skill sets do you need? Do you need to be an expert in geology? How do you make a team?
You really just need to show up. If you have friends that, you know, want to participate in the challenge, you don't have to have any special skill sets going into it. You could just be, you know, one person likes video games and the other person likes to draw. Or in the professional setting, that would be a graphic designer or a software development engineer. But, you know, I think that all you really need to do is show up. And Urban Engine for hackathons, you know, hackathon means its definition is software development challenge under a timeline, right? But this is so much more than that. It's more of an innovation competition. Urban Engine really encourages cross-disciplinary teams to come together because we believe that through communication and cross-disciplinary understandings and collaboration, better outcomes and better concepts are put together throughout the timeline.
And as we were talking earlier, you mentioned that you don't necessarily even need a team. You can show up and be placed with other people.
Oh, yeah. We'll find people for you.
And you don't have to be, it's not just for engineers or software developers. Like Tony said, this can people from all different disciplines can come in and participate. For example, at Intuitive, we just hired our first fine arts majors to come work for us, and we're an aerospace engineering and analysis firm. So, you know, there's places for managers and cost estimators and schedulers and graphic artists, and all different people can come participate. And I think that will show to some of the high schoolers and college kids that, you know, there's other ways you can participate in the aerospace industry. It's not all just engineers.
Mm-hmm. And let's get into the specifics of what actually happens with the challenge. Okay, say you show up by yourself or with the team, you're there with everyone else, the challenge begins. What really happens?
Yeah, on Friday, so it's a three-day event, and Friday is basically education prep time. There's going to be speakers and workshops that will happen to kind of get people broken into the different subject matter that the challenges contain, the technical tools that can be used throughout the
competition. And that's on October 19th.
That's on October 19th, and it's totally optional. For those that just want to participate in the hackathon or innovation competition itself, show up on Saturday morning around 8 o'clock. You can register there or check in if you've already registered. If you have a team, you can hang out, go visit some of the exhibitors that are going to be there. Intuitive is one. There's going to be a bunch of others that have tech demonstrations that are there. We're going to have a bunch of swag, grab some coffee, some caffeine, and some food. If you don't have a teammate at that point, we'll help you find a team that you can join based on your skill sets and interests in the challenge. And then sometime around 11:30 or noon, we're going to break off into teams and just get to work. It will continue through the night. You don't have to stay over at the Space and Rocket Center, but you can.
Are you talking sleeping bags?
I'm talking sleeping bags.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Right on.
If you even sleep at all, it is pretty intense, but it's really fun. And we have plenty of food and caffeine, Red Bull, coffee, junk food to keep people awake and interested in working. But you can go home if you'd like to, if you need your sleep. I need my sleep. I would definitely go home and take a nap. So that's totally cool to do too. But the hackathon will continue through the night until the code freeze or the development stop around 2 o'clock on that Sunday. And from there, we will transition into the judging rounds and finale presentations before the winners will be awarded checks. And so like Hal was saying earlier, you know, you could be a terrific engineer or software developer and have no presentation skills. So a tip for those who are listening that are interested, I would definitely make sure you have a good presenter on your team.
And as we were talking earlier, you mentioned it's not just one challenge. There are a number of different challenges that will be tackled here. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that as well.
That's the different challenges that pertain to Earth and space science. We'll know what the actual challenges are specifically closer
That's
to
all top
October
secret
19th.
Right.
That's, yeah, nobody knows. I don't know. But if you want a leg up and you want to see what some of the challenges were in years past, you can go to 2017.spaceappschallenge.org/challenges, and that'll give you an idea of what they'll look like.
Tony and Hal, perhaps each of you can weigh in on this one. We talked about exposure and mentoring and things like that. But what are some other reasons that this kind of competition is important and useful to people?
Well, I think it's real useful. One, like we were just talking about, it's a good team building exercise, whether for your family, your friends, your company. You know, companies could put teams together. It's a good team building exercise. I think it's real good, even though we've been talking about the fact that, you know, you don't have to necessarily be an engineer to be involved. It does promote STEM and STEM education. And
I love
think
that.
Expose students to some of the practical applications and some of the fun challenges that you can do in STEM. It's also, like we mentioned, it's going to be a worldwide exposure. So for those companies that want to come in either for the career fair or the rocket talks that are going to be on Friday, they want to be a sponsor, a corporate sponsor for the event, they're going to get just worldwide exposure for that. So I think this is just great for the community. I mean, this is something that is just fantastic. It gives Huntsville great visibility. It's great entertainment, you know, for folks to come out and participate in it. And like we said, and it's really going to help expose students to the STEM aspect.
Tony?
For the Urban Engine community, all of our community programming, co-working night and our speaker series events and the hackathons that we do is really just to pull people around to innovate and work on developing new creative solutions and work on their ideas. And I think that the Space Apps Challenge in Huntsville particularly is a great opportunity for people to participate in Huntsville's legacy as Rocket City now and going forward. Even if you don't do that during the day, or even if you do, it's a great way to plug in. It gives our professionals throughout the community an opportunity to do something new and fun that maybe they wish they were looking for an opportunity to do at work, but they just don't have it on their to-do list. And it's a lot of fun. And the other thing that really gets me excited about this truly is the student participation, because I like to think about those students who think, wow, this could never be for me. I have no idea how what I like to do could fit into getting a shuttle to Mars. But throughout the weekend, they're going to meet people who work on those things. Every single day, they're going to become far more humanized, world-class engineers, scientists, developers are going to be there to help them look at those challenges in a way that's meaningful to them. If you think about the way that that could impact one student's trajectory, that's enough for me to like get involved in this on its own.
The Apps Challenge is also part of a larger event, as both of you alluded to, that takes place at the Rocket Center beginning on the 19th. Hal, you mentioned Rocket Talks, Career Fair. What are some other activities that are happening on the 19th, and I assume that's something that's open to the public.
Oh, yeah. The 19th is going to be, there's going to be technology demonstrations, so there is going to be actual intuitive. I would love for you to talk about the rig that you're going to bring, because it's so cool, okay. The VR.
I will. Yeah.
It's one of the best ones I've ever got to do.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, it's really fun. But we're also going to have Rocket Talks, which are similar to TED Talks. They're going to be about 15 minutes in length that will cover some subject matter, and then we'll do a Q&A with the person that is doing the speech. We'll also have panels there that are moderated. We may be taking questions from global participants that they'll be sending to us online, so that'll be really fun to engage with the global community that way. There's going to be food, big on food. We're going to make sure there's tons of food there to keep people having a good time. And that evening, we'll have a series of educational workshops. So that's when we're going to bring in technical experts to talk about software development tools that can be used throughout the weekend, subject matter criteria that can provide additional context to those people who already know what challenges they want to work on so that they can get a leg up. And then we're going to send people home to make sure they get some good rest before the challenge starts on Saturday.
And Hal, you're with Intuitive Research and Technology Corporation. Tell us about this virtual reality rig.
Yeah, what we'll be bringing part of what some of the corporate sponsors are offered is we can set up and do some demonstrations. And what we'll be bringing, we had last year and we'll be bringing it again this year, but it's new and improved. But it's what we call our virtual arena. And as everybody knows, you know, virtual reality is the real hot thing right now. We've actually coined the phrase collaborative reality because you can actually get people all in the same virtual world and they can collaborate with each other at the same time. And
oh, excellent.
You can have people literally all across the world as long as you got an internet hookup. And those people can be virtually in the same room at the same time working on the same thing. And so we've been doing a lot of work in that area, and so we'll be bringing our virtual arena, and we'll be allowing folks to get inside a virtual world and give demonstrations to that.
And zooming out just a little bit, Tony and Hal, you as well, talk a little bit about the public service mission of Urban Engine for people who aren't familiar with that, and Hal, maybe you can chime in on how Intuitive help support this and works with them.
Yeah, well, Intuitive is a corporate partner for Urban Engine. And the reason we're a corporate partner is, you know, we're always looking in Intuitive of ways that we can help fuel the Huntsville, you know, aerospace industry, things that we can do to help improve that. And Urban Engine is, I feel like, it's a cornerstone of entrepreneurship in Huntsville. It's something that we've needed for a long time. I've lived here in Huntsville since 1963, so I've been here a long time. And it's something that we really needed. We've had other attempts at entrepreneurial incubator sites, and some have been a little bit more successful than others. But an Urban Engine is the real thing. This is the real thing. And they've got the right motivation. They've got the right people. And it's what Huntsville needs to put us at the same caliber or level of you know, Silicon Valley or Austin or Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is something we really needed. So we can have young entrepreneurs. It's a place that they can come to, or young technologists, entrepreneurs, whatnot. They can come to, they can work in an area, they can collaborate with each other. They can, you know, work on their ideas to see if there's a way to monetize them. And then Urban Engine puts on, and Tony can talk about it more, but puts on a lot of workshops for the folks. And so it's just an invaluable asset to this community. And it's something that we've needed, like I said, for a long time.
And Tony, it is a nonprofit as well.
Yep, we're a 501c3 nonprofit, and our mission is to propel Alabama's economy by connecting aspiring entrepreneurs and established business leadership to educational resources, talent, and community. Most of what we do is free community programming, like Coworking Night is the one that most people know us for, which is a free weekly conference for and by the startup community. And it's, as Hal said, it's just an opportunity for people who have an interest in technological innovation, startups, entrepreneurship, and professional development to find other like-minded individuals to collaborate with.
And finally, Hal, you and your company, Intuitive Research and Technology Corporation, are also connected with another amazing event happening in Huntsville in November, November 1st through the 4th, The Wall That Heals, a 3/4 size replica of the Vietnam Memorial Wall, will be on public display at John Hunt Park off South Memorial Parkway. Hal, why are you personally excited about the wall coming to Huntsville?
Yeah, well, we're very excited. Like you say, we're the enabling sponsor for that to come to Huntsville. And it's a very solemn memorial to our Vietnam veterans. And at Intuitive, we hire lots of veterans. We're a best place to work for veterans, been recognized as that. And so at Intuitive, not only, you know, we like to support the community and the entrepreneurship side, but we also support our veterans. And our slogan is, you know, we support our veterans both in wartime and after wartime. And so I'm just very honored to be able to be an enabling sponsor to allow this to come to Huntsville, for the local citizens to be able to tour it. Like you said, it's a 3/4 scale replica. It's very solemn. This is very serious. but you'll be able to walk through it. And if there's some of your friends or relatives that participate in the Vietnam War or veterans, then, you know, their name will be on the wall and you'll be able to see that.
Because not everyone can get to Washington.
Can get to Washington, right. That's the whole idea.
And we'll be doing some special programming here on the Public Radio Hour. Also, we have some special music programming planned for Morning Blend. And our sister television station, Alabama Public Television, I understand, has also has some special things.
Yes.
We'll have more on that. But back to the International Apps Challenge, just one last time. Thanks to both of you for coming by and sharing with us. Anything else you'd like to add about the Apps Challenge?
Well, Brett, I want to thank you very much for having us. And I would just like to throw out there the challenge. Let's companies out there in Huntsville, let's come showcase what you've got. Let's show the rest of the world what we've got. And I throw out that challenge to other companies in Huntsville.
Tony?
Yeah, when you're ready to sign up, just head over to the website. It's spaceappshsv.com.
That was Tony Eberhardt from Urban Engine and Hal Brewer of Intuitive Technology and Research Corporation talking about NASA's International Space Apps Challenge, October 9th through the 21st. You also heard a mention of The Wall That Heals coming to Huntsville November 1st through the 4th. Stay tuned for a special Public Radio Hour dedicated to The Wall coming in October. Meanwhile, find a link to enter NASA's International App Challenge at spaceappshsv.com. You can also find that link on our website. Just look for the Public Radio Hour. Hispanic Heritage Month runs through October 15th, and this show is honoring it each week with a special segment featuring some of the Latino-oriented programming we have on our regular schedule. Alt Latino explores art, music, and culture every Saturday afternoon at 3 on our HD3 News Talk channel. Let's tune in and take a trip to Puerto Rico to hear how our compatriots are recovering from last year's hurricanes Irma and Maria.
From NPR Music, this is Alt Latino. I'm Felix Contreras. We're going to do something a little different this week. We're going to mark the one-year anniversary since the Caribbean was pounded by natural disasters, hurricanes, leaving millions without power for months, destruction of an already fragile infrastructure, and almost 3,000 people lost, dead, because of the storms and their after effects. And we're also going to take a look at what many call a political disaster that was the U.S. government's response, or lack of, to the plight of over 3 million U.S. citizens. We're going to do all of that through the reconstruction of a brief timetable of events over the last year using NPR news reports to tell the story of when the storm hit, its immediate aftermath, and the struggle that ensued and that the island is still going through. Now, to do that, I've asked NPR news editor Luis Clemens to join me this week. He was the main editor coordinating NPR's coverage for our news magazines and digital outlets. Luis, welcome to Alt Latino.
Thank you, Felix.
Okay, what are we going to hear?
So we're going to hear the sounds of the first few days after the storm could be described as chaos. We're talking about lines, people in lines at the airport in Miami, people at lines in the airports across the mainland, people trying to get out of Puerto Rico, but the airport was shut down. You had shortages of cash. You had inability of people to communicate by phone because only 100 of 1,600 cell towers across the island were still functioning. You had shortages of gas, shortage of groceries. A lot of people spending a lot of time waiting.
Hurricane Maria's rampage through Puerto Rico left neighborhoods destroyed and the entire island without power. Shops, powered mostly by generators, are now reopening. Roads are being cleared, but thousands of people are homeless. NPR's Greg Allen visited a temporary shelter in a town that's been flooded.
The town of Cataño on Puerto Rico's northern coast is a low-lying community where residents don't have a lot of money. The water rose quickly here when Maria hit last Wednesday. Irma Rivera Aviles, like nearly 200 others, now is stuck in a shelter where conditions are getting worse daily. The governor needs to come here and take a look at our critical situation, she says. The bathrooms are flooded and aren't working. Sewage is spilling all over. The generator is broken and we're here in the dark. We desperately need water, power, and ice. Rivera is a Cataño City Council person who helped set up the shelter here. She evacuated before the storm because she has a house made of wood close to the water's edge in Cataño. After Maria passed, when she returned, what she found shocked her.
Volaron los techos, el zinc se me fue.
The entire roof was blown off, she says. Everything got soaking wet. The beds, furniture, everything. The walls are caving in and water is still leaking in. Although there's food provided at the shelter, there is no running water. At night, she says, with no power, residents are left in the dark and are awakened sometimes by the sound of gunshots nearby. But for Rivera and others at the shelter, their biggest worry is health care. My husband is a kidney transplant survivor, Rivera says. He's diabetic and we don't have ice to store his insulin. She opens up a blue cooler where she's trying to keep her husband's insulin cold.
Aquí está la insulina de mi esposo.
Oh, yeah, that's all the medication that his insulin, and it's the water's all melted now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We need ice.
Authorities in Puerto Rico say there are more than 10,000 people in shelters across the island because their homes were destroyed by Hurricane Maria. FEMA and relief groups are delivering food, water, and generators to the island. But in Cataño, they say so far, no outside help has arrived. Nearly a week after the storm, some areas here are still flooded. I found 77-year-old Maria Escalera calmly pushing her walker through water up to her shins.
La casa de arriba se fue todo, se le fue el techo.
She says she has enough food and water at home, but wanted to check on her nephew, whose house is in the flooded area. She's thankful that she and her husband, who is blind, are alive. Her biggest worry, she says, is that she lost her dentures in the storm. Outside the Cataño mini market, a line stretches around the building. Customers like Milena Quiñones are thrilled because the word is out. Banks are back online, their debit cards are working, they can buy badly needed supplies.
Bread, cheese, ham, everything. Everything you need. We have water.
In San Juan, there are lots of lines now. Lines of cars at gas stations waiting for tank trucks to arrive and gas to begin flowing again. Outside banks where people for the first time since the storm have some chance to withdraw cash. Along the sides of highways where cars line up in places motorists have found good cell phone signals. The government here reports some signs of progress. Water is slowly coming back in some areas. One of the most hopeful signs, Puerto Rico's power authority says it's restored electricity to two big hospitals in the San Juan area. And power is back on in part of Mayagüez, a city on the island's west side, far from the center of Maria's destruction. Greg Allen, NPR News, San Juan, Puerto Rico.
You're listening to Alt Latino. This is Felix Contreras, and we're looking at Puerto Rico 1 year later. We're reconstructing the timeline of NPR News coverage, and I'm talking to NPR News editor Luis Clements, who coordinated that. And along those lines, tell us a little bit about the behind-the-scenes stuff. What is it like getting people into a disaster area when everybody else is trying to leave?
You know, it's the craziest sensation. You ask yourself, what are we doing sending people in when there are so many people going out? But look, this is what we do. This is our obligation to provide information. And it was very hard. We looked at all sorts of options, private planes. I looked at trying to put people on a catamaran from another Caribbean island. Finally, we were able to hitch rides with some of the aid flights that were going in, some of the commercial airliners that were going in to transport aid workers. Things are happening. It's a big news story. People are hurting, and we're not there, and this is part of the USA. This is the sort of thing you would expect if you were trying to get into, I don't know, some natural disaster in some far-flung country with little infrastructure. We're talking about trying to transport our people to another city in the U.S., of trying to get people from Miami, Orlando, New York, elsewhere to San Juan.
You know, one of the things that stands out very early on is the lack of response from the office of the president here in the United States. And there were people back on the island who were very, very vocal about that, including the mayor of San Juan.
That's right. The mayor of San Juan quickly earned the enmity of the president of the United States with her very harsh criticism of the federal government's response to the crisis. I would say, though, it is important to have a couple things in context. Number one, this was the third hurricane to hit the United States in less than 2 months. Harvey had hit Texas. Irma had hit Florida. Irma had hit Puerto Rico. Irma had hit Virgin Islands.
Correct.
And you have much of the material that was in storage on the island for just this kind of hurricane was quickly shipped out to other locations. So Maria comes along, and clearly FEMA didn't have the resources, clearly didn't have the staffing to adequately deal with three major hurricanes in rapid succession, including one of them on an island. You add into that really the less than satisfactory response from Puerto Rico's government itself. When we're talking about electricity, they didn't activate or initiate quickly mutual aid agreements that would have allowed for very inexpensive resources and linemen from other states to come into Puerto Rico and help out. They botched contracts. It was moving slower than molasses. You mentioned a political failure. The way I look at it is an institutional failure. You had a complete failure of the institutions that in this situation should have been serving Puerto Ricans on the island at a much higher level, at a much more efficient level. And you saw failure at the level of the Commonwealth government. You saw failure at the municipal level. You saw failures at the level of the federal government. And you just saw people struggling everywhere. It was this crazy situation where there was aid coming in, where there were goods coming into the port, and things like the gas shortage would mean that you just could not transport that stuff to where it was needed. I mean, this was really, you talk about the storm itself and the hurricane itself, but the island was buffeted by all these institutional failures in terms of the response that just, it made it this really long-lasting, slow-moving train wreck. That, you know, took months to begin to right itself and move in the right direction.
You're listening to Alt Latino. I'm Felix Contreras. We're talking about Puerto Rico 1 year later. I'm talking with NPR editor Luis Clemens. Let's move on to talk a little bit about the infrastructure and how it was in a bad state to begin with, and then the storm came and just basically wiped it all out.
So bad in some cases, lousy in others. Remember, Puerto Rico going into the storm had a huge and unmanageable debt. $9 billion of that debt was associated with Puerto Rico's electric utility, PREPA. It was an antiquated grid beforehand. It was highly vulnerable to exactly this kind of storm. It took practically 11 months for all power to be restored to all households that lost it during the storm. I mean, that is a stunning, stunning delay or a stunning fact to accept that people in the United States of America had to go, in many cases, for months without power. It's that weakness in that electric infrastructure that is partly responsible for all those deaths that followed the initial storm. You had many people who were unable to either reach hospitals or who were unable to get their regular medical treatment or unable to consume the medication that they needed. It was just this combination that, when you think about it, it's shocking. It's shocking to think how many things could go wrong all at once and how much of that is directly traceable to the flaws in infrastructure.
Hurricane Maria wiped out Puerto Rico's electrical grid in September, and as we've been reporting, getting the lights back on has been a slow and uneven process. On the Puerto Rican island of Vieques, residents face the prospect of 6 more months without reliable electricity. NPR's Merritt Kennedy recently traveled there to see how people are getting by.
La NASA is the place to be on a Sunday night in Vieques. Couples sway on the dance floor. A bartender pulls beers out of a cooler. The bar is now a rickety patio next to a giant pile of debris. This place was reduced to rubble by the hurricane and washed into the sea.
It was a mess. It was a big mess.
That's Jose Silva, the owner, standing on the sand. He says that after the hurricane, he scavenged wood to reconstruct the small bar and reopened within a week.
You know, people, they were so stressed out. You know, they were so sad. They just want to come and cry in there. You know, trying to make people feel like, you know, you can do it.
The storm cut Vieques off from Puerto Rico's main grid. A generator-powered speaker blasts a new holiday song with a gift request. It goes, "I'm asking the three kings to bring a new generator that works." That message resonates here. Carlos Perez is the operator of the island's troubled main generator. On this morning, red lights flash on the control board. It took months to get it up and running at all. Now it's still riddled with problems. Perez works for Puerto Rico's electric utility. He says the generator is meant to be a backup when the connection to the main grid is down. Perez provides a litany of causes for this generator's problems, like difficulty obtaining spare parts and fuel and down power lines. Hernid Cruz Felix, the animated spokesman for the mayor, says there's a more basic truth here.
You can ask any resident of Vieques, and they will tell you that that generator doesn't work, that it's a piece of junk.
The electricity company, the Puerto Rican government, and the federal government all share responsibility for the plight of Vieques, he says. Vieques was used for decades as a training ground for the U.S. military, including bombing exercises, a fact that Felix believes obligates the federal government to provide more effective assistance. The island didn't have regular running water for nearly a month, he says, until generators were secured specifically to operate the pump. And cell service is also sparse. That makes it nearly impossible to run a business, says Gladys Alemán, the co-owner of an ecotourism company here.
I think it's just ludicrous that in this day and age, we don't have communications and we still don't have electricity.
The vulnerability of Vieques is starkest at the island's hospital. The main building of the hospital was damaged by the storm and now home to a dangerous amount of mold.
That is for a monitor, to the monitors and...
There's a makeshift clinic in the hospital's parking lot. Dr. Jose Carrasquillo is giving us a tour of its military-style tents.
I consider this camping.
Carrasquillo makes do with what he has. To demonstrate how he sutures in the dimly lit tents, he pulls out a small flashlight and holds it between his teeth.
I have to bring a flashlight and hold it with my mouth. Improvise, because the patient needs it.
The doctor operates without equipment that would be standard in most hospitals, and transporting patients with more serious injuries isn't always possible.
If the weather is bad, no one gets out of here. That means I'm going to have to treat anything that comes here. That's a challenge.
The precariousness of the facility scares him. The doctor fears the tents won't last long against the elements. And it's only 6 months until hurricane season starts again. Merritt Kennedy, NPR News, Vieques, Puerto Rico.
Okay, let's take a short music break to think about everything we've heard so far. And finally, a piece from NPR's Adrian Florido. Now, Adrian is part of NPR's Code Switch team, and he is now living and reporting from Puerto Rico on a full-time basis, a reflection of NPR's commitment to covering the island as it recovers over the long haul. His story is another fantastic look at the musical culture of Puerto Rico and how it infuses the spirit of everyone on the island.
Yeah, Puerto Rican bomba music has always... It's always been a way for people who dance to it to sort of forget the troubles in their lives. That was true for the island's African slaves who first started dancing bomba centuries ago. It's also been true after Hurricane Maria. So let me introduce you to Jomar Cruz. He teaches bomba. And after the hurricane, he organized a little workshop and asked people to write down how they were feeling. Here's Cruz.
Lo que más sobresalió fue, ¿verdad?, lo que es la angustia.
Cruz says that what stood out were words like anguish, sadness, desperation over having lost so much to the hurricane. In bomba music, there is a rhythm to express just those emotions. It's called yuba.
Los ancestros, nuestros esclavos, en la antigüedad utilizaban esto luego de venir de un día largo de trabajo.
Our ancestors, our slaves, danced to these rhythms after a long day of work, Cruz says, to shed their sadness.
He demonstrates Yuba's basic step, left foot to the side while bringing his right fist to the chest, then his right foot to the side, left fist to his chest, and then a verse. I'm looking for a tree to give me shade, he sings, because this tree I've got doesn't shield me from the sun. At his workshop after the hurricane, Cruz says people felt such relief dancing to Yuba that they cried. Bomba and other traditional music helped people cope. Marcos Peñalosa Pica is a musician from Loíza, a coastal community of windswept beaches and palm trees, home to descendants of the island's slaves. It's cradle of Black culture.
No había agua, no había luz, no hay televisión, no hay radio, no hay medios de comunicación, no hay teléfono, no hay nada.
We had no water, electricity, TV, radio, phone, nothing, Peñalosa says. But we had our drums and our hands and our feet, and that's all we've ever needed to dance bomba. Candela, candela, le damos. In most drum dances, the dancer follows the drummer's lead. But bomba is different. The drummer is responding to the dancer's movements. The flick of a wrist, bouncing shoulders, gyrating hips. The dancer and the drummer are in conversation. Marcos Peñalosa Pica defines bomba simply as the expression of freedom.
Campo, yo vivo triste, cada día sufriendo más. Ay Dios, ¿qué será de mí? Si no bailo esta bomba, prefiero morir.
I'm living in sadness, he sings. Every day brings more suffering. Oh God, what'll become of me? If I couldn't dance bomba, I'd rather die. Here in Loíza, there is a cultural center that teaches bomba. Maricruz Rivera Clemente is its director, and she says that shortly after the hurricane, two women, the center's oldest participants, showed up to ask if the classes would go on.
Si ustedes vinieron hasta aquí y ustedes tuvieron pérdidas materiales en su residencia, en su casa, y están aquí, pues eso nos dice mucho.
They'd suffered so much damage to their homes, Rivera says, but they still came, and that said a lot. The hurricane ripped holes in the center's roof, but Rivera resumed classes the following week. Sure, when it rained, they got wet, but in those days when so many people were fleeing the island, Rivera saw bomba, culture, identity, that emotional connection, as among the few things that might convince people to stay.
Pero hemos estado en situaciones todavía más difíciles. Sí, nuestros abuelos, nuestra gente, por lo tanto.
Our ancestors survived much worse, Rivera says, she told people who considered leaving. We have tools, we have culture to get us through this. Come on, let's dance a little.
Borinquen, mi borinquen, donde nací me crié, boricua soy y seré. Borinquen, mi borinquen.
About 10 miles from Loíza in the capital, San Juan, Alfredo Emerson has hosted a night of bomba and plena music most Mondays for the last 2 years. It's always been a popular gathering, but in the days after Maria, attendance surged, especially among young people.
Mucha gente se entera más a través de las redes sociales y de la gente. Mira, vamos para allá, que aquí no hay nada que hacer. Vamos para allá, olvídate de la calle, si no hay luz, vámonos.
They'd find out through social media, Emerson says, and they'd say, hey, there's nothing else to do, let's go there. And they liked it, and they're still coming. It's all over, this artist sings. Like the passing wind, you took everything from me, and my love has died. As they play, one young person after another steps up, bows to the lead drummer in a show of respect, and begins to dance.
You are listening to Alt Latino. We are talking about Puerto Rico 1 year later. And now I want to take some time, Luis Clemens, to talk about Puerto Rico 1 year in the future and many years in the future. Mm. What do you see as a way forward for the island in terms of how we have reporters there now? We have a reporter living there, as a matter of fact. Talk to us a little bit about that. And what do you think lies in the future for the island either in terms of recovery or politically.
So let's take the last bit, recovery. This is going to be years, right, before the island gets back to where it was before Hurricane Maria hit. We've got $19 billion from the Department of Housing and Urban Development that has been approved as community block development grants that will be going to Puerto Rico and will be used to help finance the recovery. To give you some perspective, the Puerto Rican government's annual budget is roughly $9 billion. So this is a lot of money vis-a-vis what is normally spent on the island. This is a fraction, and a small one at that, of what Puerto Rico's governor had requested Congress approve. So the big challenge moving forward is, how do we take this money that we are getting, and I don't think there's going to be more of it, and how do we make that stretch, and how do we make that work, and how do we determine that it should be spent, and how do we do so in a way that incorporates the views and the opinions and the demands and the needs of all Puerto Ricans, and doesn't just reflect the views of government policymakers. And in terms of what happens politically, well, you know, you'd have to be Walter Mercado to figure out what the next political development in Puerto Rico is. So my respect to Walter, I'll leave that part to him.
Okay, maybe we give him a call.
Luis Clemens, National News Desk Editor for NPR News. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing your expertise with us, man. Thank you.
Thank you, Felix. It's always good to chat.
And we're going to end with some music, a sunrise performance by the chorus of the University of Puerto Rico, as recorded by Adrian Florido. He says they were performing on the shores overlooking Yabucoa, where Hurricane Maria made landfall exactly 1 year ago. I'm Felix Contreras. This has been Alt Latino. Thank you for listening.
That was a special presentation of Alt Latino as part of our celebration of Hispanic Heritage Month here on the Public Radio Hour. We hope you enjoyed tonight's show. If you'd like to hear any of the segments again, check out a podcast at WLRH.org. Look under Programs for the Public Radio Hour. That's it for tonight. We hope you tune in this award-winning mix of special programs and homemade radio features every Thursday night at 7 here on member-supported 89.3 Huntsville. I'm Brett Tannehill. Thanks for listening. And remember, every day, do something good.